Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. Former Senator Rick Santorum is facing criticism and calls for CNN to fire him as a political commentator. That comes after he said European Christians built America from, in his words, nothing. Also, distribution of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is starting up again after concerns over blood clots. We'll talk with the Indian Health Service about what they plan to do. And Supreme Court justices are mulling one paragraph in the CARES Act to see if Alaskan Native corporations are considered Indian tribes. All that and pop culture. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Nez Perce tribe reclaimed ownership of property from the United Methodist Church in a small ceremony Thursday. As Emily Schwing reports, it's been more than 140 years since the tribe held rights to that land.
Roughly 40 people gathered for a small land transfer ceremony in Willawa, Oregon. Nez Perce Tribal Chairman Shannon Wheeler accepted the deed to the property. The ceremony was broadcast live on Facebook.
As we think about this land and our people being forced off of this land and the tears of sorrow as we left today, if you shed a tear, that's okay, because they're tears of joy now. And so our tears of joy and our happiness today will also be felt by them, our ancestors in the past.
In 1855, Nez Perce Chief Joseph signed a treaty with the U.S. government that granted millions of acres of land to the tribe. But 20 years later, the U.S. Army drove the Nez Perce from that same land. The Nez Perce are also known as the Namipu people. Reverend Karen Hernandez is the district superintendent of the United Methodist Church in eastern Idaho and southern Oregon. She handed over keys to a now-closed Methodist church that sits on what's now Nez Perce land in Willawa.
So we are grateful that you, the Namipu people, in a gracious spirit of friendship, are willing to meet us here as we take this small step toward justice. It blesses us, knowing that land that Methodists made good use of here, but it was never rightfully ours, it is now most rightfully yours.
This is the second land transfer from the United Methodist Church. 3 years ago, the tribe took ownership of 1.5 acres along the Willawa River, where the church held retreats. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing.
A measure in the California legislature seeks to replace the toppled statue of Junipero Serra in Sacramento's Capitol Park with a monument honoring tribes. The statue was overturned last summer amid nationwide Black Lives Matter demonstrations and takedowns of controversial monuments following the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota. Serra is credited for establishing the Catholic mission system. Native American Assembly member James Ramos introduced the measure. Ramos says it's time to engage in an honest assessment about the devastating impacts of the mission period and what it means to California Native Americans. Tribal leaders supporting the measure say the mission period represents genocide, slavery, and other degradations imposed on California Indians. Ramos is seeking public input and debate as the bill moves forward in the legislative process. The bill is sponsored by 6 tribes in the Sacramento region. The Ute Indian Tribe has advanced an agreement with the state of Utah on Indian child welfare. The intergovernmental agreement seeks to protect children and families by working together to establish policies and procedures pursuant to federal law, the Indian Child Welfare Act. Under the agreement, all judicial transfers of cases involving Ute children that may come under state court will be adjudicated to Ute Tribal Court. The agreement also restricts access to the reservation by state child welfare workers. Tribal officials say the purpose is to keep Indian children with Indian families, and no Ute child should be placed outside unless every option is fully exhausted. The agreement now goes before Utah's governor for approval. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Yeah. National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This reminder to get your COVID-19 vaccination is provided by the Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who support this show. Info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus. Come Unity, Environment is Sacred, is a series of on-demand films portraying a Native revolution to environmentally align with nature in celebration of International Earth Day. Available through April 30th at visionmakermedia.org, who support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. The Food and Drug Administration has lifted the pause on distribution of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after concerns over a very rare blood clot disorder popped up in just 6 patients. Today, the number of complications is 17 out of 8 million shots administered in the U.S. Today, we'll talk with the Indian Health Service about their recommendations on this particular vaccine. Also, I interviewed a Stanford law professor about the Supreme Court's case on federal coronavirus relief money going to for-profit Alaska Native corporations. The case hinges on how the justices interpret one sentence in the CARES Act. We'll also talk about how the ruling could have further implications for what counts as an Indian tribe. Also, Indian Country Today's Native nerd Vincent Schilling will join us to go over pop culture highlights. And of course, Rutherford Falls will be at the top of our list. But first, former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum is on many Native Americans' list for his comments at a Young Americans Foundation event on April 23rd. He was talking about how great America is. Here's what he said.
If you think about this country, I don't know of any other country in the world that was settled predominantly by people who were coming to practice their faith. They came here because they were not allowed to practice their particular faith in their own country. And so they came here mostly from Europe, and they set up a country that was based on Judeo-Christian principles. When I say Judeo-Christian, the Mosaic laws, Ten Commandments, and the teachings of Jesus Christ, the morals and teachings of Jesus Christ. That's what our founding documents are based upon. It's in our DNA. You know, if you think of other countries like Italy and Greece and China and Turkey and places like that, they've all sort of changed over time. I mean, they've been there for millennia in many cases. And their culture has sort of evolved over time. But not us. We came here and created a blank slate. We birthed a nation from nothing. I mean, there's nothing here. I mean, yes, we have Native Americans, but candidly, that there isn't much Native American culture in American culture.
And that was former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum. His comments have garnered a lot of backlash. President of the National Congress of American Indians, Fawn Sharp, called Santorum an, quote, unhinged and embarrassing racist who disgraces CNN. The Native American Journalists Association has called for Santorum's dismissal, and the organization Illuminative is circulating a petition requesting that he be fired from CNN. To talk more about this, joining us now is Savannah Romero. She is the manager of partnerships and programs at Illuminative, and Savannah is Eastern Shoshone. Welcome to Native America Calling, Savannah.
Thanks, Monica. It's so good to be on the show today.
Yeah, it's great. I want to just chat with you about this. I also want to put this out there for our listeners. You know, if you heard these comments and you saw, you know, backlash to them, you have an opinion about it, give us a call. 1-800-996-2848. We're going to spend this first segment talking about former Senator Santorum's comments about Native Americans. So, Savannah, your initial thoughts when you first heard?
Yeah, I think, candidly, my mouth probably dropped to the ground. I was in shock because I couldn't believe that a senior political commentator on CNN, by the way, who is also an attorney and a former U.S. senator, would say such an outlandish comment, right? I mean, it's just a straight lie. So I was shocked and enraged, but then was that all of those feelings shortly followed just excitement about how Illuminative could respond to this, and knowing that we were going to get on it right away. But yeah, initially just completely shocked.
Yeah, I mean, this is Illuminative's deal, right? You know, is bringing attention to the greater world about Native people. You've done research on this that shows that, you know, we're not doing that great. So if you want to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So at Illuminative, for folks who don't know, our mission, our work really centers around increasing Native representation, amplifying Native voices and stories, and just all around building power for Indian country. And part of that work is holding companies, mainstream media companies like CNN, accountable when these kinds of things happen. Our organization is really rooted in our founding research, which is the Reclaiming Native Truth Research that came out in 2018. It was co-authored by our executive director, Crystal Echohawk. And what that research really showed us were that Native peoples are, and I think this is, you know, as Native people, something that we know, right, because it's our experience. But it was the first public opinion research study ever done by, conducted by and about Native people. And it told us that, you know, across sectors of society, Native people are virtually invisible, right? And that includes entertainment, it includes K-12 education system. It showed us that, you know, Native people only appear between 0 and 0.04% of in entertainment and media, that 87% of state history standards don't mention Native people after 1900s, and that 27 states make no mention of a single Native person in the K-12 curriculum. Oh. Further, 95% of Google searches for Native people result in the pre-1900 images and context, right? So we're seeing that this invisibility of Native people is institutionalized, right? And that institutionalized erasure is the way that racism against Native people manifests today.
And so, like, going back to Santorum's comment, you know, it's really interesting. He's talking about blank slate. He's using terms like there was nothing, right? But then it's almost like an afterthought where he sort of adds, well, Native Americans. And so does that, Savannah, does that, like, bode well in terms of at least he actually mentioned Native Americans? Could we say that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he is in a boat with the majority of Americans, right? Our research also tells us that 78% of Americans report knowing little to nothing about Native people. So he's certainly not alone in his sentiments. I think that he is incredibly misled, right? I think that Native people have, I know that Native people have contributed immensely across all sectors of our society and culturally in immense ways. But I think that we're just beginning to see that appear and be center stage in mainstream media and pop culture with the release of, you know, new TV shows like Rutherford Falls, which is a great example of Native representation being front and center.
Right. But I think about when I thought about this, when I heard this comment, I thought, oh, the historical context of this and even the way that history is taught in terms of there was nothing there. And so then when you commit genocide against a group of people, if you've created this idea that there was actually nothing, then it makes it much harder to say that actual genocide happened. And so I was just curious if you had sort of pondered, you know, the historical context of how this message is really not new.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the erasure of Native people has been absolutely intentional from the beginning, right? There is a reason why we don't learn about it in our K-12 education system. If you systematically erase a people, then it makes it easier, right, to carry out continued atrocities against those people. What we see is what we care about, right? And if we don't see people, then we're not gonna care about what their communities are going through. We're not gonna address issues, right? and then we're not going to bring about solutions. And so I think that absolutely the erasure, right, that those pieces are very intentional.
Mm. Let's take a call. We've got Melvin in Santee, Nebraska, tuned in on KZYK. Morning, Melvin.
Good morning. This Mr. Santorin, I'm glad he's an ex-senator. Listening to this man, I'm thankful that he's an ex-senator.
Melvin, you've been around the sun a few times. Is this something you've heard from politicians before? You know, this idea that the U.S. is virtually nothing and we can't, you know, and colonizers came and created something out of nothing?
Well, you know, he doesn't know his own history, being from Pennsylvania. You know, many of the founders of this country, the white founders, they're so-called, went up and met with the Six Nation people. And that's where the Constitution and all that came from. You know, we had a system before they got here. And many of these, Benjamin Franklin, many of them that went up and met with the tribes, then they set up, that's where the foundation of this country was from, meeting with the natives and how they deliberated. You know, the only thing that they left out was the women. You know, they treated wanted us to treat our women like they treated theirs, was like property, you know. Mm. That was the big thing mm-hmm. for us. Mm-hmm. And what's hard for us to accept is this not having women as part of our societies and, you know, making decisions. You know, the warrior societies took care of themselves. Right? They knew their role. But the women had a lot of other roles in our societies. And once the Europeans came, and the priests were even pushing that women weren't equal.
Right. And we heard that in Santorum's comments when he talked about founding fathers, right? And that's sort of erasing the role of women in the creation of this country. We are talking about Santorum's comments. We're going to go to a short break. We'll be right back. We're spending the entire week looking into the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people. On Monday, we'll take a look at efforts by state, federal, and tribal governments to address the disproportionate number of missing and murdered Native Americans and Alaska Natives. We hope you can join us on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're tuned into Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, and it is our monthly news roundup. We're talking about comments made by Senator Rick Santorum, former Senator Rick Santorum, about how this country was birthed, made from nothing, basically. And I should mention that I did reach out to the former senator on Twitter to see if he would join us today. I did not hear back. But if I do hear back from him, he's welcome to join this conversation. And we'd like to hear, you know, further explanation of his comments. Savannah, if you got a chance to Savannah Romero is with us. She's from Illuminative. If you got a chance to sit down with Santorum and chat with him, what would you tell him?
I would tell him that his comment that he made is absolutely an illustration of how white supremacy has deliberately attempted to erase Native peoples from the past and make them invisible today. that his comments have incredibly harmful and violent consequences, and that they do not in any way recognize the genocide, forced removal, land theft, continued dispossession of land from Native people today, right? That ongoing struggle that's still very much felt in our communities. And I would want him to apologize for all of those things and do the work really to learn his history, because he clearly does not know it.
Yeah, what do you think about his last comment that there isn't much Native American culture in American culture?
Yeah, I think to an extent, right, we don't see the contributions of Native culture in the way that we should in mainstream society. But I think that also does such a huge injustice to the many and immense ways that Native people have contributed to U.S. society in a number of ways, right? From just thinking about environmental protection alone, right? Knowing that even though Native people, Indigenous people around the world only occupy or live on 5% of landmass, but protect 80% of the world's biodiversity, right? We see that protection of land and water here. Indigenous people are absolutely on the front lines of those struggles. You have our communities to think for that. There's so many ways that Native people have contributed to culture that you can see in every aspect of society. So,
yeah, I mean,
I think that.
I agree. I mean, I immediately thought about food, right? And I just took an Indigenous cooking class with Chef Lois Ellen Frank, and she was talking about like the eight major food items that really transformed the world. After Columbus showed up, you know, and so you think about like corn and tomatoes and things like that. That's the thing that I was thinking about, and just an opportunity to be able to share that more with people. You know, that's what these sort of comments bring about. So, you know, tell me about how Illuminative is planning on educating the world on how there is Native American culture in American culture.
Yeah, I mean, we tackle those things on a number of fronts. I think pop culture is one of them, right? Elevating Native storytellers to tell their own stories. Our stories have been told for the most part by non-Native people, by white people, right? So it's about time that Native people have the tools and the resources and the platforms to tell our own stories in a number of different ways, whether that is through film or that's written, or that is, through any other art mediums. That's a part of our mission is supporting and amplifying that work. And another part of our mission is really just elevating, you know, all of the asset-based narratives that are in and have always been within Indian country and community, right, on a larger scale, right? So connecting those stories with non-Native folks so that we're creating visibility, we're increasing Native representation across all sectors of society.
Getting it in there before it starts, so you don't have to go back and say, hey, where's the Natives in this conversation. I like it. Mm-hmm. Savannah, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And if you want to check out what Illuminative is up to, we've got a link on our website, nativeamericacalling.com. I want to switch gears. So on to Alaska and the Supreme Court. This month, the court heard arguments on a case involving Alaska Native corporations and the CARES Act funding. When the act came out, it contained one sentence that could be interpreted to include Alaska Native corporations in receiving CARES Act funds. The U.S. Treasury Department said that ANCs could get the funding, but tribes in the lower 48 and a few tribes in Alaska sued. And it comes down to how the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, which is referred to as ISDA, determines what is a tribe. I talked with Dr. Greg Oblaski about this. He is an associate professor of law at Stanford University and wrote about this case for the SCOTUS blog. I started by asking him what the main argument that the Treasury Department and Alaska Native corporations are making in this case.
The main argument that they're making is that when Congress passed the CARES Act and adopted this definition of Indian tribe from ISDA, that definition includes the Alaska Native corporations in their definition of Indian tribe, and that therefore they are eligible for the CARES Act funding that was set aside.
And what about the tribes? What is their main argument?
They have the exact opposite position, right? Their argument is that the definition of tribe that is adopted in ISDA excludes the Alaska Native corporations because they're not, in fact, federally recognized tribes. So a lot of the fight is about this definition, particularly at the end, there's a requirement that they be recognized. They talk about which are recognized for services by the Department of the Interior. And their argument is that that language excludes the Alaska Native corporations, even though they're specifically listed in the definition.
Yeah, do you think that it could come down to literally whether or not they consider the word recognized?
Oh yeah, I think actually a lot of the oral argument turned on exactly how to interpret this requirement of recognition. So not to get too legal on this, but part of the argument was about whether this is a, what it's called a term of art, meaning a term with specific legal meaning, or whether it had ordinary meaning. So a lot of the fight was actually about what federal recognition might mean and whether it required being included on the LIST Act, the list that the Department of the Interior maintains of federally recognized tribes.
Right, and Alaska Native corporations do not show up on that list every year.
That's right, so the Alaska tribes do, right? The Alaska Native villages that are federally recognized, they are on that list, but the Alaska Native corporations are not.
That's what you called the series qualifier canon.
Yeah, so this gets into the statutory interpretation, which is this whole area of law about how you go about interpreting the language in a statute. And then there's actually two interpretive canons that are at odds here. One is the series qualifier canon, that is, that the term recognized applies to all the things that come before it, including the Alaska Native corporations. The canon on the other side is the sort of presumption against surplusage, which is basically when Congress includes words in a statute, it intends them to have meaning. So why did Congress specifically include Alaska Native corporations in this definition if they didn't want to specifically include the Alaska Native corporations? This is actually two competing views on how you interpret statutes that are at war in this case.
This makes my head hurt, okay?
Yeah, sorry, welcome to law school. You're not alone.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot of this going on these days. This is, you know, the justices, I mean, we saw this in McGirt too. The justices have really embraced textualism, that they're really focused on the text in particular. And that has worked out well for tribes in McGirt. In this case, where you have native interests on both sides, they're going to turn to the text to try to parse out the distinction here.
Forgive me if this is a really silly question, but was there any idea of maybe just going back to the people who wrote the legislation and asking them, what did you mean here?
That's what's called legislative history, where you go and look at the history of the law itself and try to figure out what they meant. And once upon a time, that was how the court often looked at these questions, but that is actually not the favorite approach right now. Increasingly, they look only to the text. And the argument there is, how do you know what Congress meant? It's a whole bunch of different people. They all got together. They all had different views about what they thought they were doing. Maybe they didn't even think about what they were doing. And so that was actually the very first question that Chief Justice Roberts asked during the oral argument. He asked the attorney for the Treasury Department and said, well, you look a lot at the history, the legislative history of this statute, but we don't care about that anymore. We're only interested in the plain meaning of the text. So this has been a big shift in the way that the Supreme Court in particular has gone about the process of figuring out how to interpret statutes.
And so what could be the broader implications? Could they literally be redefining what Indian tribe is in this case?
Well, potentially it could sweep very broadly. And there was some concern, the Treasury Department expressed some concern about if they give a broad meaning to what federal recognition requires, then maybe it's no longer limited to those federally recognized tribes that appear in the List Act definition, but perhaps even state recognized tribes or other groups could make an argument that they could qualify under ISDA. So there is that concern floating around that would apply to really all of federal Indian law. But then there's a lot of Alaska specific concerns. And a lot of the question was sort of about how different Alaska is and what the consequences would be for Alaska. And you have competing views on both sides about how dramatic the consequences would be. The Alaska Native corporations argued that it would be a substantial reordering of the status quo. The people on the other side, including the federally recognized Alaska tribes, argue that actually it would unsettle their view of the existing order, in which they are the ones who are providing most of the key services.
And that was Greg Avlasky. He is from Stanford University, and I talked with him about the Supreme Court case of Alaska Native corporations and CARES Act funding. All right, we'll keep an eye on that case and follow it as the ruling comes out. Switching gears now, let's talk vaccines. The FDA lifted the pause on the distribution of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Joining us now is Captain Matthew Clark. He's the lead for the Vaccine Task Force Safety and Monitoring Team at the Indian Health Service. Welcome, Captain Clark.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
All right. So let's talk. I just briefly mentioned in the intro there was some concerns. It was a relatively small amount of people who were having blood clot problems after taking the vaccine. What else can you share about that?
Right. So just to clarify, on April 13th, IHS requested all of our sites to pause administration of the J&J Janssen vaccine, mostly out of an abundance of caution after recommendations from the FDA and CDC following those six cases of a rare and severe type of blood clot in individuals after administration of the Janssen COVID vaccine.
Mm-hmm. And so then the FDA has lifted sort of the pause on that. Because the rest of the country did it as well. Where does IHS stand?
So you're correct. So the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices held an emergency meeting to review any subsequent cases on April the 23rd. There were additional cases. So inclusive of the six original cases, there were a total of 15 reported during the public ACIP meeting. Following that pause of 10 days or so and following that thorough review that was undertaken by the ACIP, that committee recommended to the CDC and the FDA to lift the pause and use of the Janssen vaccine based on its evaluation and its determination that the vaccine is both safe and effective.
So IHS will follow that committee's recommendations then?
Correct. So beginning on April 23rd, IHS resumed use of the Janssen COVID vaccine. And of course, we'll continue to monitor the safety through our various surveillance systems of not only of this vaccine, but of all the vaccines in use across the IHS system. We have a fairly robust safety monitoring system that includes the CDC's vaccine adverse event reporting system.
Yeah, that's where you can report if you do have reactions to any vaccine that you take. So can you share a little bit about what are the symptoms of the blood clot situation, or what should folks look out for?
Yeah, so I think that's an important point. So for individuals who experience either severe headache or breathing difficulty or swelling in an extremity or severe abdominal pain, frankly, in any of those circumstances, we would recommend that they notify urgently a medical provider and seek evaluation. And if in those circumstances they also happen to have recently received a Janssen vaccine, of course, we would recommend that they advise their medical provider at that time with that additional information.
All right. So, I mean, you know, folks, there's been a lot of concerns about vaccines in general. There's, you know, some hesitancy in the Native community about getting a vaccine still. What can you say? Is this vaccine safe?
I feel very strongly that not only is the Janssen vaccine highly effective and safe based on the available information, but so too are the other two vaccines, the mRNA-based vaccines from Pfizer-BioNTech and from Moderna. I think we also need to keep in mind that extensive clinical research was put into the development and evaluation of these vaccines prior to public use. And there's also now fairly extensive information following implementation of the vaccines at the national level that indicates the safety and effectiveness of these vaccines. And of course, it comes in the backdrop of the severity of the pandemic, which has had undue impact in Indian country.
Yeah, I want to talk with you more about the effectiveness of the vaccine. In particular, I got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and as they were giving it to me, they said it was, I think they said it was like 60% effective, and I was reading that some of the other ones were much higher numbers of effectiveness, which I was feeling kind of sad that I had gotten that one. But I want to talk to you more about that. After the break, we are talking with Captain Matthew Clark. He's the lead for the Vaccine Task Force Safety and Monitoring Team at the Indian Health Service. You know, if you've got a question for him, we can squeeze one in. Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
Support by the Sioux Trading Post, whose special selection of dried herbs are chosen for superior quality, and many sage, sweetgrass braids, and red willow bark and cedar are wild-crafted. All available at SiouxTrading.com. Wopila.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. It's our monthly news roundup. And before the break, we were talking with Captain Matthew Clark. He's the lead for the Vaccine Task Force Safety and Monitoring Team at the Indian Health Service. Okay, so Captain Clark, I mentioned I got the Johnson & Johnson Janssen vaccine. My thinking behind it was that I put my name on the New Mexico list to get it. And it was, you know, it popped up. They offered it to me. It was the first thing that was offered to me. So I took it, right? But what I've read is that maybe it's not as effective as the other vaccines. But then I've heard some other, you know, evidence of that it's just as good. So what are your thoughts?
So my thoughts are that the best COVID vaccine to receive is the first one that becomes available to you. And I base that on fairly clear information from the clinical trials about not only the effectiveness of the vaccines in preventing COVID illness, but more importantly, their effectiveness in preventing severe illness. So you alluded to, you know, some differences in that first number, and that's true. The mRNA vaccines were shown to have about a 94% to 95% effectiveness in preventing laboratory-confirmed infection in the phase 3 clinical trials, and the Janssen vaccine was 66.3% effective in preventing laboratory-confirmed infection in the clinical trials. However, more importantly, the Janssen vaccine was 100% effective in preventing severe infection, hospitalization, or death, very similar to the mRNA vaccines. So I think we have to consider what it is that we're trying to accomplish with our vaccination program. I think particularly in Indian country, recognizing that very high level of effectiveness at preventing severe illness is very important.
If you have the choice between, you know, like all three, we had someone on the show who was saying they went to IHS and they said, we have all three available. Which one do you want? Which one would you choose?
So I want to reiterate that that all three are highly effective and safe. And, you know, the best vaccine is the first one you can access in the circumstances that you are discussing, which is when there's an opportunity to choose. I think that's an individual decision. For instance, someone may decide that a single-dose vaccine is better for them, in the case of the Janssen vaccine, for reasons perhaps related to where they live or their ability to get back for a second dose, whereas someone else may, have a preference for one of the mRNA vaccines. So I think, as a program, the IHS would very much like to offer people a choice and provide, informed consent to that decision-making and then respect the decision of the vaccine recipient.
And so, final thoughts for folks who are still haven't, maybe they're on the fence or they just want to wait it out and see how things go before getting this vaccine. What do you want to say to them?
I would like to say, especially for the good people in Indian Country, we have three safe and highly effective vaccines. We have plenty of supply. We would very much like to answer any questions that people, ongoing questions that people may have, but also to encourage vaccination at the earliest possible point. Early on, we had a lot of enthusiasm from the early adopters of vaccination. We now have a tremendous amount of information. Over 300 million doses of COVID vaccine have been administered nationwide in general, and of course, well over 1.2 million in the IHS. We have a tremendous amount of information about the safety and effectiveness of these vaccines. And, now our goal is to protect not only ourselves as vaccine recipients, but really to protect our elders, to protect our higher risk members of our community, and to protect the community at large. And that's going to require something called community immunity. And while nobody knows for sure what that percent rate is going to be, we anticipate it's going to be somewhere on the order of 70 to 90% of the community vaccinated, fully vaccinated. So as we move forward, I would welcome dialogue with anyone who still has outstanding concerns related to these vaccines. But I would also encourage everyone who has yet to be vaccinated to please consider doing so.
All right, Captain Clark, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
And if you've got questions about the vaccine, you know what? You can send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. We're probably going to do a few more shows about the vaccine as well as the pandemic progresses. And we want to hear what you're thinking about it. So give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. If you want to weigh in, we're going to talk about pop culture next. And like I said, if you want to talk about the vaccine, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. All right, let's check in with Vincent Schilling. He's the associate editor for Indian Country Today, and he's Akwesasne Mohawk. And he loves to nerd out about anything that has to do with movies, TV, or popular culture. Welcome back, Vince.
Hey. That's right. I like to nerd out. I'm a native nerd, as some folks know. I have a column, Native Nerd, and I write a lot of arts entertainment, reviews, etc. So yes, of course, I love this world of arts entertainment and media, etc.
I do too. Okay, but before we get into that, I just we were talking about former Senator Rick Santorum's comments. I want to give you a moment if you want to weigh in about what he said. Go for it.
I just was like, okay. I heard it, early on. I think it was like even Friday, and I posted something to TikTok, and my TikTok's been going bonkers, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
The Native community on TikTok is just huge, and I had so many responses, and people were just like, okay. So it really kind of just kind of goes to show you that people live in their ivory towers and feel the way they feel without really any connection to what's really going on. And it's this disconnection that leads people to stick their foot in their mouth a lot of times.
It's not nothing, That's what I wanted to say.
There is
nothing.
No, Native culture in American culture, or there's not much Native. Okay.
Okay. So, talk about mainstream culture. I mean, this week, man, last week I was so excited about Rutherford Falls. And the excitement continues. I know that I think you said this is your new favorite show. Just break it down for me, like that first episode that you watched. And
oh my gosh, it's just incredible. Yeah. Let's see, it's about, gosh, I'm not even sure. It's maybe about 2 months ago, NBC actually reached out to me, which was kind of something amazing in itself. Said, hey, Vincent.
Right.
You know, hi. And I was like, what the heck's going on around here? Wait, you know, I'm not having to knock down 7,000 doors to get information. They came to me. And I said, yeah, we got, you know, as you know, Peacock TV's coming up with this. Would you like to see the first four episodes? I was like, yeah. And, you know, so I sat down and watched them, and I was just blown away. And then they came back to me and said, hey, you want to talk to, you know, some folks on the show, you know, Sierra Teller Ornelas, Michael Gray Eyes, Ed Helms, Janice Schmieding. I was like, yeah. So I got to interview them. And it was just incredible. So I sat down to watch this television show called Rutherford Falls. And I, you know, knew that Janice Schmieding was in it, as well as Ed Helms, because that's in the poster. And being true to my native roots, the first thing I noticed were these huge dangling earrings on Jana's ears. And I was just like, wow, how often is that seen in mainstream media? Never. And so I'm watching the show and I'm watching these two characters interact, you know, Regan Wells and Nathan Rutherford. And I'm just blown away because he is, you know, an ally in some sense, but an also a white apologist and a guy who really wants to get it but doesn't.
Yeah, kind of a bumbling.
Hilarious.
Yeah,
they are friends. and then in comes Terry Thomas, played by Michael Gray Eyes, who's just killing it, crushing it in the comedic spectrum. And I'm just like, what is going on here? These are stories I have not seen before, and here it is.
Yeah,
on TV.
Yeah.
Where was this when I was a kid? And it was just, I was just delirious with giddy glee and excitement of how great this show is. It's just brilliant.
I know. It's just, I'm just like doing fist pumps in my house by myself. Like, yes, I can't believe it. It's so great. If you want to learn more about Rutherford Falls, we, of course, you can read any of Vince's interviews and articles at Indian Country Today. Also, we had Sierra Teller Ornelas, the co-creator of Rutherford Falls, who's Navajo, as well as Janice Schmieding, who's Lakota, and Bobby Wilson, who's a writer and on the show as well, on Monday. And so you can go back into our archives and listen to that pretty incredible conversation. Vince, do you have any inside, do you know if they'll get a second season or anything like that?
If they don't, I will be blown away shocked because yeah. I've been looking at some of the stats on Peacock TV, actually. And I don't know the exact numbers, but it was like 44 million, I think, new subscriptions. And a large percentage of that were monthly subscribers. You know, I don't know the numbers of the show, but, you know, I've heard that it was received exceptionally well. And if it wasn't picked up for a second, I would just be completely shocked. I strongly suspect that it will be.
Yeah.
It's just that Ed Helms, Janice Schmieding, Michael Gray. Come on, it's just hilarious.
Yeah, what a departure for Michael Gray Eyes. You know, I didn't know he could do. I always see him as just so serious and everything like that. And he is serious, but it's like deadpan funny serious.
Right. Well, this was, and I had this interview with him, and I was asking him about that. I said, "This is your first foray into comedy." And he was like, "Yeah, I'm a newt. I'm a baby. I don't know what I'm doing." And he said he was surprised. He goes, "Well, you know, I'm not sure how to play someone who's comedic. I know how to play a badass. I can play a badass," which he said Terry Thomas is. And we were having a conversation. I said, "You know, comedy. The root of comedy is sincerity." In complete sincerity in these, you know, preposterous ideologies, and if you can manage that sense of sincerity, it's hilarious. And he goes, during my scenes, I was shocked that it was funny because I was being real. And people are like, ha, ha, ha. But he's funny because, you know, one thing that sticks out to me is when he looks at Janice Schmitty, he goes, you know, anybody else who talked to me is insulting. He goes, but I find your candor oddly refreshing. You know, and it was just straight out, but funny. He's a hilarious straight man, and I just love his character.
Yeah, yeah. We could talk for hours about Rutherford Falls. It's just, you know, full disclosure, I've worked at National Museum of the American Indian with Sierra, so I may be a little bit biased about it. I knew I was going to love it from the beginning.
I'm Native, and there's a Native show. I'm biased, yeah. You know, but it's brilliant. And I'm getting a ton of comments, people who aren't Native going, this thing is brilliant. This is hilarious.
It's really hilarious. All right, let's, you know what? This is a remarkable year because we have another show that's coming out that's made by Natives, that features Natives, Res Dogs. What do you know about this, Vince?
You know, I know you want to call it Res Dogs because you know how it is.
No, it's not called that, right? It's called
Reservation Dogs.
Reservation
Dogs.
People
call it Res Dogs because that's what we do, and that's good, and that's probably what it's going to be called. But yeah, it's an upcoming comedy series by Taika Waititi, Sterling Harjo. And it's actually even going to be at Tribeca, I just found out. So I'm lining myself up at the Tribeca Festival. So, you know, this looks like something that could be pretty funny. I don't know exactly where it's going to go. They haven't released many details about it yet other than, you know, they're putting it together. And it's slated to premiere 2021. That's as far as we know.
So, all right. Well, we're going to keep an eye on that for sure. That's going to be pretty exciting. All right, Vince, what else are you excited about? What's coming up? What do you want to chat about? We've got about 2 minutes.
Well, we got Killers of the Flower Moon, of course, coming in Oklahoma and talking about the Osage murders, you know, and, you know, I think that as far as Native content goes, I think we're going to continue to see more and more stuff. And I'm hearing a lot of insider chatter. You know, I can't share any specifics, but, you know, the desire for Native content, let's just say the antenna are raised very highly and people are looking for these alternative content creators that are not usually what we've been seeing over the years. So I'm excited overall about this incredible, you know, bodies of work. And let's talk about, you know, the Native character coming to Marvel, you know, that's going to be in the Hawkeye series, you know, as Echo, mm-hmm. you know, which is a Native character that is deaf, played by a Native actress that is also deaf. So there is so much incredibly immersive, great content out there. I'm just thrilled. And I'll tell you one more thing I'm excited about is the world of TikTok. Boy, is it blowing up.
I love TikTok. Oh, man, I waste so much time.
I just posted something and got 250,000 views on my video. I'm like, what's happening? It's incredible. I'm excited about people are telling me all the time on TikTok, thank you for sharing this information about Native culture we didn't know. So there is a huge movement. People want to hear Native voices on TikTok. So you have a Native voice, get out there. You know, it doesn't matter what you post. Post what you know. And it's wonderful. People are really being receptive to it. You know, social media, you know what you get. But
yeah.
There's always, you know, grumpies, but there's also incredible support.
Well, if you don't know about TikTok, go ask your grandkids to put it on your phone and get you set up with it. All right, Vince, thanks so much for stopping by today. It's always great to talk with you.
Yes, thank you.
And also thanks to Savannah Romero, Captain Matthew Clark, and Greg Vlasky for joining the show today. We're back next week with 5 shows exploring the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, men, trans, and Two-Spirit people. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our host is Tara Gatewood. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Bruno Spencer is the engineer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. And Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our resource development specialist. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief of operations. The president and CEO of Quantic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. Have a good weekend.
Support by the Sioux Trading Post, proud to provide traditional and contemporary American Indian craft supplies, from feathers, furs, and hides to conchos, fringe, shells, and beads, all available at SiouxTrading.com. Wopila. Support by Northern Arizona University. Explore a career in business, policy, environmental science, health management, and more. Their interdisciplinary and online degrees will meet your career needs, where indigenous knowledge is applied. nau.edu/native.
Healthcare coverage
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.